Are you ready on the bridge, Bill?
Close.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. Like to welcome today's Revenue Committee, open today's Revenue Committee hearings. We are this morning implementing a sales tax for the state of Oregon. That's a joke. April Fools. Got to get that on the record since we are on the web. Welcome, everyone. Actually, we have three bills here. We have, while he was missing, a signed Senate Bill 297 to be carried on the House floor by Representative Wand.
Excellent.
And so would you explain it to us, please, Representative Wand?
Certainly.
Okay, it's April Fool's for having some fun.
Okay.
I can't wait till Representative Ear Brewer walks in the room.
Well, and she's carrying her own bill, which is on there, and we don't have her here. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3454. Chris, would you like to explain this to us?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3454, as drafted, needs some work.
That's never happened.
I think what I'll try to talk to is what I believe the intent of the bill is. It pertains to net operating losses and how the state ties to federal law with respect to those, and a consequence of disconnecting from federal law certain provisions, namely the bonus depreciation is the big piece. And you'll note that the bill is drafted for corporations, but my understanding at the moment is that it's not actually not an issue for corporations, because in Oregon law we have our own definition of NOL. The problem arises on the personal side, where for those taxes we take the state NOL is the federal NOL.
Okay.
And so, and again, this is as I currently, what I believe the intent is and how I currently understand it. If at the federal level a taxpayer gets bonus depreciation, that can push them into a net loss situation. And for the years that we disconnected from bonus depreciation, the idea was that they didn't get the advantage of that, the extra deduction. The conflict, if that's the right term, arises, and at the state level, we just take the NOL at the federal level. We just say whatever you're, if you're in an NOL position at the federal level, that's what your NOL is for the state, and thereby you get the benefit of the bonus depreciation.
Okay.
And the idea, so you get the benefit of it in that first year, and in subsequent years, in Oregon law, you also get to subtract the idea at Oregon law when you disconnect from the bonus depreciation. Okay, set what I just said, put that aside. I'm having flashbacks from Wednesday.
You should be.
Unfortunately, this isn't a joke. Okay, so set that aside. Now, with the bonus depreciation, the idea was that in disconnecting from it, in that first year, there would be an add back on the Oregon return. You basically don't get that marginal benefit.
Right.
And so there's that tax increase in the year one. And in all the subsequent years on the Oregon return, there is a subtraction to account for the difference in depreciation. So over time, for the depreciation, there wasn't a tax difference. It was all a timing issue. So year one, tax increase, and years two through four, five, six, seven, there was a tax decrease compared to federal law.
So that it zeroes out.
Well, when a taxpayer is in an NOL position, in that year one, they never had the add back, because they were able to take, they benefited from the bonus depreciation via the NOL provision. So they didn't have to add back. So there wasn't that tax increase in year one. And then, but in years two, three, four, and five, there still was a subtraction. So I believe this is the double dipping that, or the so-called double dipping that the accountants were referring to when they were here. What I'm still a little fuzzy on is in year one exactly how on the tax return the pieces all fit together, because on the Oregon return, there is an addition, there is a line where you have to add back that bonus depreciation. But there's also a, now how I think, this is how I think it fits together. When somebody fills out their Oregon return, they have to add back the bonus depreciation, and that's the mechanism for which the tax is collected. Mm-hmm. But then in the subtractions, there's another subtraction for the net operating losses. And so our law, state law about the NOL says whatever your federal NOL is, that's what your other subtraction is. So you've added it in one place and subtracted it in another place, so there is no net addition to the Oregon tax in that first year of the bonus depreciation.
Questions for Chris? I'm having flashbacks too.
That's my current understanding. I'm still talking with folks to work out.
Representative Benz.
Just because of the confusion, the confusing nature of the device, if you're still talking to people, are we prepared to do something today, or are we still waiting?
No, and we have somebody to testify on the bill.
Right.
Okay, hopefully. Patrick, would you like to come forward?
Sure.
Would you like to wade into these waters?
I'll get this all cleared up.
Thank you.
Not a CPA, is he?
He represents nurseries. And I'm sure he understands it perfectly.
Not so sure, Madam Chair. I would like to weigh in on how we understand the bill so far, but it sounds like it's still in the works. My name is Patrick Kapper, Government Relations Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'll be brief with a couple of comments. Just a little history on where the nursery and greenhouse industry has been recently from an economic standpoint. The nursery and greenhouse industry has been hit hard by the rapid decline of home and business construction, high transportation costs, financial lending woes, and a depressed national economy. Like other Oregon businesses, Oregon's nursing industry has been caught in this severe economic downdraft and are faced with business losses, decisions to reduce production, or laying off employees. We have seen increases in competition and trade wars by other states, and we have seen transportation skyrocket along with healthcare, energy, and labor. We believe that this bill, again, as we understand, and I understand that there's still some, sounds like there's still some work that needs to be done, but it provides several critical elements that will assist not only Oregon's struggling business community, but in particular the nursery and greenhouse industry. Providing nursery operations to identify net loss from prior year and make it a deduction. The flexibility of this law is recognition by lawmakers that aggregating net losses have a real impact on the long-term productivity and employment of hardworking Oregonians. Look forward to where this bill goes and what the final product looks like, but we support the concept currently and happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Patrick from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to speak to this piece of legislation? Thank you for coming, Patrick. And I'm
Is there an amendment in the works, or where we go? Where do we go from here?
I haven't seen an amendment. I think, as evidenced today, there's still some question as to exactly what the intent is and how it works, and there are a lot of questions about it. So still trying to figure out talking to people.
I have my own, so yeah.
So.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
With that, without further questions, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3454. And Kate, you're here for 297, and so I'm going to open Senate Bill 297. This is Representative Wands, bill to carry, and he's going to explain it to us as soon as Kate Togswell's done.
It makes technical fixes to the tax code.
Thank you, Representative Wands. Which ones? In what way? Kate, thank you very much. This is the revisor's bill, and it's tiny.
Good morning, Chair Berger, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Kate Togswell from the Office of Legislative Counsel. The tax revisers bill this session is Senate Bill 297. I can walk through the sections if you'd like and explain the intent, but I can let you know for the most part, this bill deals with income tax credits that are no longer available to taxpayers because they apply to past tax years, but they remain in the Oregon Revised Statutes, and we are now doing cleanup to repeal them. And that is the case for Section 13, which contains a number of income tax credits, the fish habitat credit, the qualified adoption expense credit, pollution control credit, and the reclaimed plastics credit. And also,
those are 315, 134. You're talking about Section 13.
Exactly. Section 13
is pretty simple, basically.
Yes. It's just by looking at the bill without knowing what the ORS numbers are, you wouldn't necessarily know which credits they are. But in Section 13, which is on page 5, there are a number of sections which are repealed. And
Will you go through those again? What do they refer to?
315-134 is the fish habitat credit. That actually sunset in 1997. And for the most part with these credits, they have remained in law because there's a... You can either claim them over a number of tax years and or there's a carry forward. So there might actually be a few taxpayers who are still able to have them on a return. But the most recent sunset of these actually in Section 15 is the telecommunications facilities credit, and that was 2005. Okay. So we've gone through and looked for credits that are no longer of use to taxpayers, but they're actually still law. The law is in effect, but they're not applicable.
So we've got the fish habitat and...
315-274 is qualified adoption expense credit, which sunset in 2005. 315-311 is the pollution control tax credit, which sunset in 1999. 315-324 is reclaimed plastics, and that sunset in 2001. Then further down the page, in line 39, Section 15 repeals... 315-511, which is telecommunications facilities credit, which sunset in 2005. 315-604, which is the bone marrow transplant expense credit, sunset in 2001. And then finally, 316-095 with sewer connection credit, sunset in 1995. So there are all of those which are basically, it's cleanup. They're no longer of use to taxpayers, and also the carry forward has expired at this point. Then looking at Section 1, that actually deals with a manufactured dwelling credit, and it makes a change to conform that provision to House Bill 2009, House Bill 2067, which adjusted the sunset for that credit, but neglected to make a change in a related piece of statute.
So it doesn't do anything with the credit.
It does nothing substantive.
Okay.
It just is necessary to align that with the changes that were made in the House Bill 2067 last session, which adjusted sunsets of numerous credits.
Okay. What else?
Then in Section 4, that actually is sections that deal with the telecommunications facility income tax credit, which is repealed in Section 15. So that, in a way, is a conforming change.
Okay.
Then moving to Sections 5 and 6, that actually makes a change which is necessary to affect the intent of provisions that deal with two accounts. And essentially, the way that the current law is worded, it requires transfer of a certain amount of money at a point when the account from which the transfer is to occur is empty. It requires, or
that,
measured
that would
at
be,
a time.
That would be page 3, line 6, accounting impossibility.
Chairburger,
provisions.
Exactly.
Okay, we love those.
So that trues up those provisions. So the amount is actually measured at a point when the the account has been filled as opposed to after it's been emptied.
Timing, a little timing issue.
It's a timing question.
So you have to write a check for zero.
Exactly.
All right.
Or bounce a check.
Oh, that's an easy check. Okay. I'm going to let her go through all of this, by the way, so we get a scope of it, and then committee members, you can ask your questions as we, okay?
Chair Berger.
But if you have something really pressing, please signal so. Okay?
Moving to sections 9 and 10 of the bill, which are on page 4, those deal with discharge of tax liability when taxpayer dies performing military service. That required that it would be filed on or before December 31st, 2006. So that provision is now obsolete. It's repealing those provisions.
That's 9 and 10 both?
Yes. Those are related provisions. And then skipping over 13 and 15, which we've already discussed, Section 16 through 19 make technical changes to the provision that provides for appropriation to the department to make refunds. And we've realized in Legislative Council that we had a number of provisions that are current law but that are not actually applicable, and that the wiser course of action would be to have one provision that is actually applicable rather than printing numerous sections in the ORS in anticipation of the way the law will be applicable in future years. And 316.502 is that provision. And in the current book, we have four versions of that, only one of which is applicable. And the reason for that is this deals with refunds to taxpayers, and in particular, well, all types of refunds, but also refunds of refundable credits. And there have been bills in the past that have either adjusted the date of when a credit would or would not be refundable or provided for the repeal of a refundable credit. But where the repeal is not to take place until 2014, we've realized that having these multiple versions that may or may not actually become applicable is more, it creates more potential for error and is more confusing to people who are using the statute as opposed to having the version that is actually applicable. And we can then make sure that we adjust it as necessary.
Okay. Questions? Yeah. Rep Vance, do you have?
None.
Is that?
Well, I have one, if I may. And I think it may be the one you're, well, anyway. I take it that you're keeping track of all this stuff so that when a bill comes up that makes a change in something that is related to this statute, you'll stick the correction into the bill that makes the other change.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, yes, we do. And we track all of this, but we realize the better practice would be, rather than risking an error that's actually a substantive error, that we have one version of the statute, and then when it does need to change, we change it.
One version in effect at any one moment.
Yes.
Thank you.
Instead of having several versions that are in effect, but some of them are not actually applicable until the year 2014 or even the year starting 2018, and having them printed in the book is more confusing than it is useful, even though they are the law. They're just okay. Not applicable yet.
Oh, okay. So I get it. It's a timing issue. If it isn't applicable until that year, it doesn't go in the books until that year.
It's more of a distraction than
Got
anything.
Got it. Okay. That's, I think we understand. Okay, what else?
So moving to Section 21 deals with provisions providing for referral of reinvested gain. And that required action on or before December 31st, 1999. Those are the provisions starting with 316.871. Okay. Those are still on the books, and those are being repealed in Section 21. And then Section 24 on page 7 also deals with the reclaimed plastics credit. And the credit itself is repealed in Section 13 of the bill. Section 24 is the accompanying provisions for that in Chapter 468. Section 26 on page 9 is a related provision for the telecommunications facilities credit, which was sunset in 2005. And then in sections 27 and actually also 28, we have done a cleanup of duplicate provisions dealing with the credit for diesel engines and also the credit for manufactured dwellings. And those provisions were, there were changes that were made in legislation in the 2007 session, and we had virtually identical provisions that were enacted in separate bills and separate committees. And those, we were unable to editorially eliminate those provisions because they weren't identical. And the reason they weren't identical was because of the internal references were different, because the section numbers in the different bills were different. And we have now gone through and cleaned those all out. So we will no longer have two note versions of, there are numerous provisions that are printed twice in the current ORS, and specifically they're dealing with the diesel engine credit for diesel engine retrofit and the manufactured dwelling park closure tax credit. And that's what is happening in Section 27, and related cleanup is happening in that section.
So, Kate, let me get on the record that as a revisor's bill, there are no policy changes in this bill intended, or it is a revision to clean up the statutory language and has no intent of any policy.
Chair Berger, Chair Barnhart, that is correct. There are no substantive changes that are made in the bill.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Guys, questions?
Yeah. How many credits does this bill repeal?
It's about 10.
Okay. Also, we're moving ahead with one of the goals of the committee.
None of these are, they're all, as I had said earlier, they've all expired.
No, I got that part.
Any carry forward that might have been available is now gone and done.
Okay. Further questions? Good job.
There is one.
Yeah.
Is this bill ready, or does it need amendments?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, I believe this bill is prepared. It's ready.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't see anyone else out there who's pining to talk about this bill. Do I? Okay, then we will. Thank you, Kate. Close Senate bill, public hearing on Senate Bill 297 to coming to a committee near you. We're going to open Senate Bill 57. Mazin.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, we're starting to see more Senate bills come our way. The Senate Bill 57 basically takes out the electric facilities generation from the prohibition that was previously in law, or currently in law, excuse me, it's not previously yet, about the economic development projects. Basically, it allows those economic development projects, if they are to bond, that they could consider those economic, the projects that are electric energy transmission or distribution or generation to be eligible for those financing through those bonds. These are revenue bonds or conduit bonds that are primarily benefiting from the ability of the state to bond, but not necessarily a state obligation.
Okay. Thank you. Questions of Mazin?
One, if I may. Do you know why there was an exception for up on line 10 and 11, the language that's coming out, facilities designed primarily for the generation, transmission, sale, or distribution of electrical energy. Do we know why that was? Maybe we'll hear it from the witness about that.
Yeah, we have someone from Business Development.
Okay, maybe I'll ask that person. Yeah.
Lynn, will you, I think the answer man is coming forward. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, and Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Schessler. I'm the Deputy Director of the Business Development Department. To respond to your question, Representative Barnhart, this legislation is very dated. I can't tell you what year it came into play, but frankly, it was during the years when utility companies, frankly, wanted to ensure a monopoly on energy generation, didn't want anybody getting in the business. And frankly, the legislation is obsolete for a variety of reasons, mostly because the thinking of utility companies has changed dramatically over the course of the years, and now you'll see them actually encouraging the development of generation on the small scale, at least, to feed into their systems. And also, technology has changed through the course of the years so that small solar arrays, frankly, are feasible and do generate power, certainly not at a utility plant scale. But the technology now fosters smaller generation facilities, and that's why we're pursuing this legislation. The issue became critical when the American Recovery Act was introduced and the recovery zone bonds were provided to local communities. Local communities saw that as a terrific opportunity for them to very inexpensively finance solar arrays at their water treatment or wastewater treatment plants to offset the utility costs that they were paying. But unfortunately, cities have the same prohibition in statute that we do. And the cities came to the state seeking us to use our industrial development bond authority to finance those small solar arrays. But we were prohibited by statute, the one that's referenced here. So we were all left leaving those projects on the table because we couldn't finance them. I would just point out that the federal tax law pertaining to industrial development bonds does allow the use of industrial development bonds for electrical generation facilities. So what we seek here is to bring our state law current as well as in compliance with the federal tax law related to industrial development bonds. And just let me assure you so that you don't think we'll go wild with this, the federal tax law related to industrial development bonds places a limitation of no more than $10 million per financing. So again, we're not going to be financing utility scale coal plants or anything of that nature. This is really giving us the opportunity to do, as I mentioned, solar arrays at treatment plants or areas where communities might have acreage of scale so as to be able to create solar arrays and help offset some of their operating costs. That's it. A second sort of assurance for you that we won't go wild with this is that all of these bond authorities, the issuance of those bonds, has to be confirmed with the permission of our commission. So there is a second safeguard there that, you know, there's more than just the department looking at or the federal law provisions looking at what we do with this industrial bond authority. And with that, I would be glad to respond to any questions because that's about the depth of it.
I'll go if no one else will. I have kind of a series that go together. As I understand, this is a conduit bond, which means that the bond is to be paid for by revenues or at least from some other source than the state.
Chair Berger and Representative Barnhart, that's exactly right. We pass the responsibility through and get assurance through whoever the eventual recipient of the proceeds are of a guarantee of some sort that the state does not become liable for the repayment of these bonds should there become a default. They partner with a local banking entity or finance entity that they have a close relationship with to assure that we are not liable as a state for any action or shortcoming on their revenue side.
Okay, and then if I could follow up, are we talking about bonding for publicly owned facilities, or are we talking about bonding for privately owned facilities, or what?
Chair Berger, Representative Barnhart, predominantly the experience we've had pursuing this particular provision in statute was for public entities. But let me be clear that industrial development bonds, the conduit authority, does apply for private enterprise as well. And we have done not utility-related industrial development bonds, but other facilities for lumber plants. Frankly, the big project that we performed related to the recovery zone bonds was the financing for the Intel facility in Hillsboro.
Additional. You indicated that cities have a restriction in their statute around similar kinds of bonding. Is that in this bill? And if it's not, why isn't it a change in that statute?
Chair Berger, Representative Barnhart, their prohibition is similar. Yes, it's not in this bill simply because we were trying to respond. And, I think if the cities were at the table, they would probably indicate a preference for us doing the industrial development bonds because we can do them probably cheaper and at a scale that saves some expense and the cost of issuance over what they could do as an individual, local, smaller project.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then additional. If I remember correctly, and we haven't touched on this, the treasurer tends to bundle this stuff and sell it through the underwriting facilities that he has available. Am I remembering that right, or are these handled in some way differently than other bonds that the state of Oregon touches? I say touches because they're not our bonds, but in all the other cases that I know about, the treasurer is responsible for making certain that the details are handled correctly and that the bond underwriting is adequate and the undertakings are correctly drafted, those kind of things.
Chair Berger, Representative Barnhart, you're right on point. I won't say that the treasurer insists on a bundling of them.
Mm-hmm.
We try and do that at the local agency level, but certainly the treasurer oversees the issuance, the dates, paces the entry into the market so that the market isn't flooded. And, of course, they do review the underwriting and all the terms and conditions of the sale that we eventually issue. But it is absolutely with their permission and coordination with them.
Okay. Then this is my last one. If the treasurer didn't like what he was seeing, he didn't have to issue the bond at all, does he?
Chair Berger, Representative Barnhart, if the treasurer doesn't like what he's seeing, we're not doing a bond sale.
Thank you.
Just to be clear, however, you're talking about the general program of these revenue bonds. This bill only changes to allow electrical generation facility to be included in one of the projects, which is what is prohibited in statute.
Accurate.
And when you're talking about the cities may have similar statutes. That we don't repeal city statutes. We could only repeal state statutes.
That's accurate as well.
Thank you. This is
particularly related to our department and its industrial bond authority.
And we don't have the authority to tell cities what statutes they need to repeal.
Certainly, Chair Berger, I don't.
Okay,
just a quick follow-up. When you used the word statute, I assumed you were talking about a state law that restricted cities' activities. Were you, in fact, referring to city ordinances?
Chair Berger, Representative Barnhart, the prohibition is in state law, which prohibits local financing of these same activities.
Right, that's what I understood you to say.
I understood him to say that cities have similar ordinances that prohibit it.
Not ordinance, state law.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it.
But we do have control over that.
We have control.
Cities and most counties as well.
Yeah. Okay, got it. Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I'm clear on this, are these the private activity bonds that the Oregon Bond Manual refers to? I was just trying to make sure I had these corralled in the proper place. Is that what this is?
Chair Berger, Representative Benz, yes, these are private activity bonds. They are tax exempt at the federal level.
Yes.
And then I was just reading from the Bond Manual, and it says that for the most part these bonds are issued as conduit loans. The state or local government issues the bonds and loans the proceeds to private entities to carry on the activity in the manner prescribed by federal law. Is that a correct description then of what this does, or is this?
Trevor, Representative Vance, yes.
Follow up.
Yes.
Then the money so obtained is loaned by the department to the group, organization, private folks doing whatever the organization is trying to do. I mean, are we between, are we making a loan is my question. We, the state, we, the department.
Chair Berger, Representative Vince, we are issuing bonds. The proceeds are passed to the financial partner of that local borrower, and we rely upon the practices and oversight of that financial institution to assure the coverage of and repayment of the borrowings to the bond holders from that borrowing entity. I probably confused you with that. But essentially, we're issuing new bonds. Proceeds go to the financial institution. Financial institution passes them on to the borrower as a loan. Borrower pays back the financial institution. We're frankly out of it because we have there are bondholders then that are repaid through a distribution, usually the Bank of New York, where the payments go from that financial institution.
I just want to make a follow-up.
Thank you.
Thank you. So there's no risk then to the state as a result of this change we're making, no increased risk?
Chair Berger, Representative Vince, yes.
Yes, there is no...
Yes, there is no risk.
Thank you.
I wasn't an April Fool.
Okay. Further questions? I think we've grilled this and drilled this.
I thought this was simple.
Well, nothing is simple in the Revenue Committee. Anyone else like to speak on this? John, are you coming forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. I didn't sign up because I came down mostly to listen to the explanation, and I would say I'm not necessarily opposed. I'm strongly skeptical, particularly because of lines 9 and 10 there, that 11, repeal of that section. I think before you act on this, you should probably have a more vigorous discussion about why that was in there, why it would be repealed. There's nothing particularly mysterious about the generation, transmission, sale, distribution of electrical energy. If it can be done feasibly, there's financing in the markets. There's no particular reason to me why the government needs to be involved in that. And the example given by the previous witness, several examples involve solar projects, which almost are always financially infeasible by a long shot, except for subsidies. Which raises the question of why would we get into the subsidy business yet again when the state over the last 15 years has become increasingly enmeshed in the utility business where we have put ratepayers and taxpayers, which are pretty much the same, as silent partners into all parts of the utility business through things like the Betsy program that has gotten out of control, the public purpose charge that has crept along, generating a lot of money that ratepayers have no say over, and the RPS that now mandates considerable purchasing requirements on utilities of certain politically correct types of sources. And I guess I'd raise the question, is there any part of that business that you think the state shouldn't get into? And if so, where is it? Or are we just always going to keep getting citizens of the state further and further enmeshed in something that can and should, in my view, be done by the private sector, or if it's a municipality and they have some solar array they want to do on a treatment plant, that's their business. And if that can't be done conventionally, then I would say it's probably not worth doing. So I just think that maybe a little more research, perhaps by your staff, into this whole question. I'm sure there was a very vigorous discussion by your predecessors at some point as to why this type of activity was specifically prohibited originally, and probably worth a real discussion about why you would want to now get into that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for John? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, I went back and looked in anticipating possibly questions of the nature you're asking, why these bonds would be issued or could be issued, and of course the general underlying rationale is that the benefits of the bonds accrue to the public and the bonds are going to be used for public purposes. So that drew me down to why the Economic Development Commission would be in the business of making loans to commercial and industrial economic development projects, which is again called out in the bond manual. And your remark regarding whether it's generation, transmission, distribution really applies equally to that which is already allowed in commercial, industrial, economic development projects. So your point is, of course, why should the state be in the business at all of incenting any type of economic activity, be it utility activity or anything else? So my question to you is, having said all of that, is there a distinction in your mind between that which the department is now allowed to do and that which they're asking they be allowed to do in addition?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, you raise a good point. And to me, we're way down this slope, so this keeps us going down the slope. I believe that the whole walk down the slope is fraught with problems. We shouldn't keep going down there. I believe you're much better off playing the role of the umpires, call the balls and strikes, create an environment that is conducive to wealth creation, job formation, and stop being partners with thousands and thousands and thousands of these entities where the citizens of the state have no idea that they're even partners with these people, where citizens may be bearing risk, but the reward, where does the reward go? Mostly to these partners that we're subsidizing with. I don't think you should keep going further in that direction. You should pull back, if possible, to simply create a structure that is conducive to wealth creation.
Oh,
yes.
John, it seems to me that your remarks regarding today's extension or expansion of the device apply, as I said earlier, equally to that which we're already doing. So it seems to me that if we think the department has value today, this extension merely adds to the arsenal of tools they have available for the very type of economic development they're already doing. And I agree with you, and this is a discussion we've had in other committees, and I think it's a very valuable one. So I appreciate you raising the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions for John? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Madam Chair, I think I have another question for Lynn.
Okay. Lynn, would you like to come back up? Oh, you're bringing
some reinforcements.
Bringing reinforcements.
All right. The previous witness just prompted another thought about taxation. You were very careful to say that the use of this facility establishes a federal tax interest exemption for the bond interest payment. I think that's what you said. What does it do, if anything, in connection with the state of Oregon taxes? Income taxes on the interest.
Chair Berger, Representative Barnhart, there's only the tie that exists between use of the federal tax return and how that's interpreted and applied with the state tax return.
So it's included as part of the definition of income.
Right. They're federally tax-exempt bonds, not state tax-exempt bonds.
Okay. Let me follow up just to be sure I understand. What that would mean then, an Oregon resident who purchased these bonds would be exempt from federal taxes on the interest, but not exempt from state income taxes on the interest.
Correct.
Thank you.
Because they are not state tax-exempt bonds.
I have something, and I can't put my finger on it, but there's something instinctually to me that I would like to proof that out a bit more.
Okay. I think that maybe we ought to have more discussion here about how this exactly works, but we need to get the questions on the table. Further questions? Yes, Mazin has something he wants to.
I tried to bring you a softball, Chair, but it seems like
Chris has been working on that this week too.
Well, I think just to go back to the idea of why are these been in the law before. Of course, you know, electrical energy in general and generator of electrical energy are in what we term in economics as a natural monopoly. The most striking example of what so-called natural monopolies, which has to be done through a monopoly, but at the same time, it doesn't have to be done through government control. So it is a utility that is regulated by the government, usually. So if you allow the government as an economic development to give loans to a utility that is regulated by the government is kind of becoming a whole different ballgame within the utility business. So I think this comes from that distinction. Now, this is a lot bigger net than just the distribution. Now you have a new thing with the wind energy, and people are trying to get into the solar system energy and so on. And these are new, smaller types that do not necessarily have to be completely owned or operated by utilities, but they could. And I think this is where you have probably a little bit from the past, or where the natural monopoly exists versus the new, when you have the small operator that wants to come in, even the consumer. Does this completely fix the issue? I don't know. So, but that's why it's a monopoly, and that's why we have the PUC, if you will.
Right, to regulate that monopoly. Further questions from, yes.
Chair Berger, let me clarify maybe current day circumstance. The Recovery Zone Bond Act and the demand that brought this issue to the forefront, that opportunity has passed, although there's some prospect that Congress may once again provide an incentive by way of that bonding authority. So the circumstance and the situation I described that identified the issue isn't currently a situation, and industrial development bonds are for use by private activity. The municipal interest anymore, because of the expiration of the Recovery Act or Recovery Zone bonds, is not a motivator anymore. I think the bottom line that I would like to emphasize related to why is this important is because these are federally tax-exempt bonding. That interest rate advantage to any business now that uses industrial development bonds is that competitive factor that makes them have a cheaper financing to be competitive in the market versus having to go to the private, more conventional financing entities. So, I mean, this is just an opportunity for a business that may want to do the solar array for their own energy generation to reduce their operating costs, and the additional advantage of the federally authorized tax exemption in that financing that makes them more competitive, and that's why we're pursuing this.
Okay, further questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just again noting that the benefit at the federal level is says here about 30%. You can get, is that still true? Because the bond manual is back in 1998. I'm just curious how much the respective benefit is that these bonds would provide to this private entity utilizing the device.
Chair Berger, I'll let John Saris, who's with me, respond to that. But generally, I think the 30% benefit, maybe back in 1998, would have been accurate. Today, I don't think it is that extreme. I'm guessing it's more in a 20% range these days, because currently, rule of thumb is tax-exempt over taxable bonds is about a 1% difference. So, and in market rates now of 5% for financing, you know, it's, you know, 20%.
Would you like to weigh in and identify yourself, please?
Chair Berger, Chair Barnhart. For the record, my name is John Saris, and I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. Excuse me. So one thing that I would add to that is Deputy Director is correct. It is about 20 basis points or 20% at this time. And really, the percentage of savings is based on the tax, basically tax liability of the lending institution that is acting as the conduit issuer or is offering the standby letter of credit that's backing the bond. So based on the financial institution, their taxable rates would determine what that tax saving is then passed along to the borrower, which is the private business in this case.
Yes, Mr. Bentz. I would like to caution you, sir, that the under discussion here is whether we want to change this program, not the whole program.
Point taken. given that this is an expansion of an existing program,
thank you for that.
Is it correct for me to understand that that other states are offering this device to their private companies, and thus, in order to keep up to this with this race toward whatever, the we must have this device in play, kind of like these enterprise zones? Or is this something that the state doesn't need to have as a device available? I've asked for a couple of reasons. First, the improved amount, the opportunity to borrow for less is obviously a benefit, but also the availability of the credit would be of interest. Are these organizations going to be able to get the credit from some other source if we don't expand this device to allow the use of this access to capital?
Chairs, Representative Bentz. This is a restriction that really, to the best of my knowledge, is only in play in Oregon. And from that regard, other states are able to offer this exact same financing to businesses that are in the business of generation, manufacturing, and the conduction of electricity. So to that point, yes, it would be a limitation, and it would be a factor that many businesses, as they are looking to expand, it may impact their decision to expand in this state or another state based on the cost of financing.
Thank you.
Further questions on the bill? Yes.
Well, I would simply note, in reference, I think, to what Mr. Charles said, and in comment on the last question and answer, is that we find ourselves in positions a lot of times that we believe we have to respond to the financial world that has been established for us by changes in federal law. And we may or may not think that some of these ideas are really great ideas, but whatever we think about them, not taking making a change that disadvantages businesses in Oregon as opposed to businesses in other states makes it is a difficult thing to do.
Further questions, comments? Thank you, gentlemen. Anyone else? I'm glad to have these softballs before us. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 57. I would like to reopen, with your indulgence, members of the committee, the public hearing on House Bill 3454. Representative Brewer, would you like to come forward and speak to your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Barnhart, and you're letting me be late and missing this. This bill is actually a committee bill, but I drafted it. It is one that I think is necessary, but the bill as presented was done on short order, and it is one that totally needs to be gut and stuffed. This is, as a practitioner, as a tax practitioner, there's a hole in the system that we have, and it has to do with net operating losses. And it came up, Bob Karras, when we were here in the Reconnect conversation, also mentioned it. And I think he and I and any other tax practitioners in the rooms were the only ones who understood what he was saying. But there's a problem going on. There's one where tax policy as a practitioner does not meet up with statute, but the Department of Revenue has administrative rules. We'd like to give them the statutory authority to tie it up related to corporations. There's a practical aspect, and I'll get into the specific details on this, with pass-through items coming through to a taxpayer, whether it be individual, trust, or corporation, where information is not being accurately communicated, and I believe as a state we're leaving money on the table. So what I want to do is technically fix this. One is to make sure it's in our statutory framework, but two is to bring better awareness to tax practitioners. We're often, even among the best, this either one flies under the radar, or two, they are not given the information to accurately report taxable income. We have federal, in general, federal net operating losses and Oregon net operating losses. As we know, Oregon's taxable income starts with federal taxable income and then goes through what we call modifications, subtractions, and additions to federal taxable income, and we come down with Oregon taxable income. However, in the case where there is a net operating loss, Oregon's net operating loss in general is equal to the federal net operating loss, with the exception of what's called prohibited amounts. Tends to be items, the most common one is U.S. Interest. We can adjust for prohibited amounts, but that's it. We cannot adjust the net operating loss for other modifications. The biggest issue, and I know I'm going in the weeds, but it's important for you if you can hang with me with or without coffee at this moment. The biggest obvious one would be, like, for example, bonus depreciation. Let me tell you how that impacts net operating losses here. For federal purposes, someone is allowed bonus depreciation. They get a 100% of that deduction, let's say. If they have a federal net operating loss, their federal net operating loss includes 100% deduction. For Oregon, in some years past, we have not allowed bonus depreciation. So the Oregon net operating loss, though, by connection to the federal net operating loss, effectively gives them 100% bonus depreciation. On a go-forward basis, though, there will always be a makeup of they will get the federal depreciation, let's say it's 100%, is done in year one, but let's say it's a seven-year asset. For Oregon purposes, that asset's going to be depreciated over the following 7 years. In many practical applications, but wrongly applied, is the in year one, the net operating loss for Oregon will be as if it had 100% bonus depreciation, and that's correct. In the second year, that net operating loss will be applied, but there will also be an additional subtraction to Oregon's taxable income equal to the second year of depreciation on that seven-year asset for Oregon purposes only. However, they're not entitled really to that second year depreciation on it because they've effectively taken it in the net operating loss. But there's a disconnect in some entities. If Jules is looking as bored as he is right now, I'm feeling sorry for the rest of you. But trust me, there is a disconnect statutorily and in practicality between making sure that someone is not inadvertently double-dipping on modifications, deductions, or potentially additions of income when they're in the when they have an operating loss that they are carrying forward. And we have timing differences between federal and Oregon law. And so this law only talks about in the purview of corporations and tries to even that up. The real issue is not just with corporations. If you have only within yourself as a taxable entity and you need to self-correct in these modifications in a net operating loss situation, it's easy to do. However, many taxpayers are involved. They have an ownership in some kind of pass-through entity. The pass-through entity may or may not accurately communicate any modifications on a go-forward basis to the to the partners above, and that can be problematic. And what I believe, and I think the Department of Revenue, who is here, may be able to opine on this, I believe we need to clarify some statutes. We need to help the Department of Revenue have the ability, some kind of communication mechanism, whatever, to correct the reporting of this. I became very sensitive to it in the last few years when many people have had federal net operating losses, and I am not convinced statutorily. When we have timing differences, eventually everything equals to zero. I'm not convinced statutorily that it does, and I believe we're leaving money on the state, either statutorily or inadvertently through practical application.
Representative Brewer.
Yes.
I think we understand what you're saying.
Good.
Okay, at least I do. The question is not that there's a problem. The question that comes to my mind is there a fix? We have lots of problems, but not all problems are fixable. So what would you propose as a way towards, I mean, certainly Department of Revenue needs to be part of talking about how this might work. Other states, what's your suggestion for getting out of the weeds and getting to a statutory fix?
I think because of the timeline, we won't be, unless Department of Revenue can work really hard right now between now and our session, I think we should target February to come back with this fix. I think it's one that needs to happen, and it is somewhat comprehensive. We also need to get the practitioners involved, too, on how do we practically communicate and handle this. But there is money on the table, I believe, and I don't believe practitioners are trying to game the system. I think it's one where we need self-education in it, sensitivity to it, and we need to help our statutes.
Okay.
Yep. A couple of questions and then maybe a comment.
Sure.
I think I understand what actually happens. If a company actually shows a profit instead of a net operating loss, how do we, as a practical matter, differentiate between Oregon's depreciation rule and the federal depreciation rule in the example that you gave?
They have a modification. In that case, they would have an addition or subtraction. Depending on if Oregon gets more or less depreciation in that year, so that would simply be added or subtracted to federal taxable income.
Okay, a follow up.
Yes.
But if I understood what you said correctly, those modifications aren't allowed if there's a net operating loss?
When calculating the Oregon net operating loss, that is exactly correct. The Oregon net operating loss is equal to, in the year generated, not in the year utilized subsequently, in the year generated, the Oregon net operating loss is equal to the federal net operating loss, and it disregards modifications, which would be the increase or decrease in depreciation.
So one possible solution might be not to disregard Oregon modifications?
It is one possible solution. You're absolutely correct. It is one that has been, I'm not sure the policy making, the thinking at the time that the policy was made way back when on that, and I'm sure that that is part of a broader comprehensive discussion, but it is a solution. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, and just a comment then. At various times we're connected and disconnected, and so that it gets a little confusing.
Yes.
But if often one of the objects of disconnect is to try to maintain revenues. If a company was in a situation in which it had a net operating loss for federal purposes because it was making a lot of investments and was essentially deducting, expensing them, because the federal law allowed that, Oregon law didn't. Then a modification that might very well result in them showing a profit for Oregon, which would have the tendency that the purpose of such a modification in the statute would have in the first place of preserving some revenue for the state for that tax year. So anyway, as a suggestion, as you're working through this complex issue, I think you may want to consider a change in Oregon law that actually puts into effect the point of having, of requiring a different depreciation schedule at all. which is, of course, to preserve revenue during a downtime.
Mm-hmm. I would agree, and thank you for that consideration, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, when there's a federal loss and an Oregon taxable income in the same year, Oregon does not generate, then does not create an Oregon net operating loss. So in that situation, it's not there. It's only when Oregon also has a loss in the year generated for the federal operating loss. But to your point, you are absolutely correct that there is a huge policy statement in there, and we want to be consistent. And we don't want to circumvent the accurate policy that we've established as a legislature. And so whatever that policy is, we just need to make sure that there isn't a technical slide-by that no one intended. And that's it.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Your explanation
Thanks.
Was good. It is a complex piece. Anybody else want to speak on this while we've got it open? To be continued, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3454. With nothing more to come before the committee, we will adjourn our House Revenue Committee, and we're meeting Monday at 7:30 for... Oh, we're not? Oh.
It's the sales tax bill. Right.
April Fool's. We are not meeting on Monday.
Oh, we're not? 7:30? That was really hard.